Welcome to the Donna Sebo Show. Donna is an international mental practitioner, award-winning author, counselor, speaker, teacher, and radio TV personality. Dedicated to empowering others through her mental skills, she also features authors and experts from all over the world to share their knowledge and experience with you, the listening audience. Now, let's join Donna and her guests. Here's Donna.
Hello, and welcome to An Hour of Mind Power. This is Donna Sebo, and today we are going to be talking about conspiracy power. Aha, yes. Does that intrigue you? Well, if it does you as much as it does me, I mean, hey, what makes good conversation? A good conspiracy of one type or another. Well, today we're going to be talking about the NASA conspiracy. Nick Redfern is my guest, and he has been on my show before. Nick, I want to welcome you to the program.
Well, thanks, Donna. Thanks for having me on again.
Well, you know, I find the word conspiracy just absolutely, immediately brings up this M5 type of stuff, and gee whiz, all of this subterranean government activity, and it is intriguing to so many people. And of course, as soon as that topic comes up, people will all have their own opinions and attitudes about what this might be. But you're talking specifically, your book was titled The NASA Conspiracy. Nick, you are involved in writing full-time as an author. You lecture, you're a journalist, you write for a number of very well-known magazines, you've gotten a number of books, you've been on the History Channel's show Monster Quest and UFO Hunters, you've been on National Geographic's program. What made you take up the NASA conspiracy? Why was this so important? Haven't we bashed this around enough?
Well, that's actually a good question. I mean, the prime reason is because, you know, as an author, I think like a lot of authors, regardless of what you write about, you know, people will read your previous books and then often contact you to relate their experiences. And one of the things that I found is sort of over about the last 15 years that I've been writing books, I've got a substantial number of reports, data, and testimony from people who'd actually worked in NASA that had never been published before. And, you know, when I began to put it together, I realized that, wow, you know, there's a lot of material here that, although it's a number of books have already been written about NASA and UFOs and things like that, I was able to bring a lot of new information and cases to the table. And I always think, regardless of the subject matter, as an author, and also as a reader of books as well, you know, you don't want to just go over old ground. And the fact that I could bring a significant amount of new material was one of the things that sort of prompted me to, you know, to sort of really think about doing a book on this and demonstrating all the new material.
I always find it intriguing how as many people, especially as they're getting into their 70s and 80s, will come forth with information that just is mind-boggling because they had taken an oath of secrecy and they say, no, I know I may not have long on this earth. Maybe they're sick, or they just say, gee, what are they going to do to me? They're going to kill me? I mean, who cares? I'm in my 80s or my 90s. And I had a very good friend. In fact, I broadcast with this individual for a number of years who was involved in secret intelligence work during the Second World War. And he wouldn't talk about it, but he got very, very incensed over the fact that so many of those individuals involved in World War II, Korea, and even Vietnam were starting to come forth, and this goes back about 10 years, starting to come forth publicly. And he had a very difficult time dealing with that because he said they took an oath and that oath should be honored regardless. Well, in each and every case, these individuals that, in his mind's view, that broke the oath, broke it for a reason. They didn't do it just because they wanted to get $1 million or something like this. No, they didn't do it for that at all. They did it because they felt it was time for the truth to be told because they felt like they had been betrayed. Did you find this the case when you were getting this information from various individuals, some of whom we'll talk about?
Yeah, I think that's definitely, well, I know I should say, that's definitely how, you know, a lot of stories in the UFO community, and certainly to me, do come forward, is that you get a lot of people, you know, as you point out, very old and probably less sort of concerned when they're 70 or 80 than they would have been 25 or 30 or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think one of the important things that prompts a lot of people to come forward within the UFO research community is that although they may feel they're breaking oaths, they also take a degree of comfort and feel that, you know, there's not going to be a backlash because the government actively denies there's any reality to the UFO phenomenon. So in other words, you know, we're not talking about a subject that the government is saying is classified. They're saying, no, there's no validity to it. So in other words, if action is taken against these people, it actually vindicates the story of what they're saying. So I think, you know, that fact in itself is a very important one when it comes to understanding how and why people do speak out. And, you know, and of course, one of the things I always ask for and look for is background testimony and information to support, you know, the person's story. And
mm-hmm.
I think, you know, when we are able to vindicate and demonstrate that a lot of these people are highly qualified, very respected military and intelligence people, you know, this to me destroys any sort of notion of, you know, fantasists and hoaxers when there's no motivation for them for doing something like that. You know, it's not like they're looking for monetary compensation or to be, you know, on the front of magazines and newspapers or whatever. They just want to get something off their chest and get the story out there. So.
Mm-hmm. And I think that that's very important. I really do. And I think that when it can be done in what I call the real form of journalism, not the hyper spectacular garbage that so often is put out there that isn't backed up with information. But these are some very interesting reports. Talk to us. Let me back up just a moment. I really, really loved a particular section of a paragraph you had. You said by 1957, in the course of a little more than a decade, the human race had successfully developed atomic energy, flattened two Japanese cities with atomic bombs, working on advanced missiles and rocket technology, and we had left this planet to explore outer space, all within a very short period of time. And look at the technology that we are advancing in this generation at this time. It's just absolutely incredible. Let's talk about the Brookings report, and I want you to also talk about MacTonnies, MacTonnies. He's passed away, but talk about the Brookings report and his statement that he made regarding what the government was doing.
Well, the Brookings Institute is probably one of the more little known, but certainly massively significant aspects of NASA's involvement, not just in conventional discoveries and search techniques and, you know, projects in outer space, but also in relation to the whole issue of UFOs and alien life. Now, at the dawning of the 1960s, pretty much right after the formation of NASA, NASA actually contracted with the Brookings Institution to prepare a lengthy document. He had sort of the tongue-tying title of Proposed Studies on the Implications of Peaceful Space Activities for Human Affairs. Take a breath.
Yes, I'm going to say take a deep breath.
A very sort of, as I said, lengthy titled report, but it basically dealt with the issues and the problems that might face NASA, you know, the further it ventured into outer space and as its projects and programs got more and more complicated and expansive, if you like. One of the areas that the Brookings Institution discussed was that relative to what would happen if NASA uncovered evidence of alien life. And the report discussed, you know, what if we found alien life via radio signals, but still, you know, countless light years away from us, you know, just by radio and nothing else? Or what if we found evidence of ancient civilizations, ancient structures, etc., on some of the planets and moons in our own solar system? Or thirdly, you know, what would happen if we actually met aliens face to face? One of the intriguing recommendations or areas of discussion in the Brookings report was not when the general public should be told, but even if the general public should be told that alien life had been found. And there are also discussions about how this could impact on the economy, on religious belief systems, on the psychological mindset of the population. So in other words, it was clearly a document that laid the groundwork and the foundations for the way in which NASA today, even 50 years on, treats the UFO phenomenon and, you know, why they treat it with kid gloves, I think, you know, the very fact that there are these spin-off areas that could be problematic in terms of telling the public. So they pretty much prefer not to tell anybody. But you bring up Mac Tonis, who made a very valuable statement with respect to the Brookings Report itself. He said, if our own history is any example, technologically robust civilizations inevitably subsume less sophisticated cultures, not merely by violently dismantling them, but by introducing a virulent strain of apathy. The infamous Brookings Report to NASA recommends that the discovery of extraterrestrial artifacts be covered up for fear of paralyzing research and development enterprises, stands as perhaps the most explicit elucidation of this idea. We appear to be interacting with an exceptionally patient intelligence, which despite its advantages over terrestrial science, seems limited by a steadfast refusal to make itself widely known. And I think this is an important issue, namely that NASA and I think the government as a whole recognizes that there's a genuine UFO phenomenon, but the fact that it doesn't do sort of the typical sci-fi scenario of landing on the White House lawn, but it stays mm-hmm. like a silent partner very much in the background, they don't know how to deal with it. And I think they've taken the Brookings Institution's report on faith, if you like, and have said, essentially, if we're not sure what's going on, we're not really having a full handle on the situation, let's tell them nothing. And I think that's what's following the process of Brookings from half a century ago.
Well, I really appreciated his statement when he said, I propose that this intelligence has played a significant role in occasionally hastening our species' development as well as keeping us in a periodic standby state, rendering us less likely to destroy ourselves. Mm-hmm. And he said he believed that the human legacy has been scripted to conform to an alien template about which we know little or nothing. This is a fascinating man because this is a man that has a depth of understanding mm-hmm. that
oh yes, you're right. Mm-hmm.
Very few people in science I've ever experienced. I mean, he would have been a wonderful person to have a conversation with.
Oh, it was. I mean, Matt was a good friend of mine. It was a tragedy. He died at the age of only 34 in 2009 of a heart ailment. Just died in his sleep one night.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, it's horrible. But he left us, the important thing is that he left us with a massive legacy of really solid, thought-provoking work. And I think Matt made a good point where, you know, that there's a good argument to be said for the idea that some sort of non-human intelligence has guided or manipulated us in some fashion over the years. Not necessarily in a sinister fashion, but who knows what fashion. But that it's kind of stayed in the background, almost in an ethereal like way, if you like. But that it may well have sort of spontaneously prompted certain developments at critical times in our history. And we may not be seeing the bigger picture. You know, perhaps we are some sort of experiment in some respects in somebody else's bigger scenario, and we're just seeing, you know, it from our own perspective, kind of like the goldfish in the goldfish bowl sees the food mm-hmm. dropped in once a day, not realizing, you know, the bigger things that are going on around him.
Well, I think that's very true. Look at how long human civilization thought that it was flat on a piece mm-hmm. of sort of like a dinner plate
yeah.
special, and lo and behold, those people that tried to say, excuse me, but we're rotating, we're a globe, and we're just this little itsy-bitsy speck mm-hmm. out in a universe that is so humongous, and they'd be put to death for that kind of a statement.
Oh, yeah, you'd be burned at the stake or whatever, you know.
And that wasn't all that long ago either. So we still
right.
have some people
right.
with that kind of mentality. It's very
yeah.
difficult to step outside of that tiny little box of thinking and of indoctrination, whatever our environment might have been. And it's only when we are able to expand our experience that our thinking begins to expand, too, when we look at variables. Let's talk about Gordon Cooper. This is a man that had, now we're going back into the time frame of the 50s, but holy Moses, there was hundreds of craft. We're not talking about a few. Well, we're talking about hundreds of craft that were seen in 72 hours over West Germany. Let's talk about Cooper, because he was an astronaut.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, this is a very important issue. You know, Gordon Cooper was one of the original Mercury astronauts on NASA's Mercury manned space program. And why Cooper's so important is, you know, for twofold reasons. One being, you know, that he was a NASA astronaut. You know, you don't get more credible than that. But also, you know, a lot of people think if you want to become an astronaut, you just apply to become an astronaut. That actually isn't the case. You know, you are required to have a significant background in aviation and science and technology. And certainly that's what Cooper had. And in the early 1950s, specifically in 1951, he was serving with the U.S. Air Force, based in West Germany at the time. And, of course, you know, West Germany bordered upon East Germany, and then you have the Soviet Union. And, of course, at the height of the Cold War, missions were routinely patrolled or put into place in that area. And the Russians did likewise. You know, it was a case of, you know, just standing up against each other and saying, hey, we're here, and a bit of bluff and bravado and, you know, telling each side not to attack, etc. So, you know, they were doing these routine missions. And over the course of a three-day period, on one particular occasion in 1951, Cooper and a large number of his colleagues, saw what can only be described as like large, classic, silver-gleaming flying saucers traveling in the skies of West Germany. And, of course, as trained pilots, you know, trained to recognize aircraft at a distance and at a close distance as well, could see these objects, whatever they were, didn't have wings, didn't have tails, no evidence of engines or propellers, nothing at all, no vapor trails, just classic flying saucers. And this, as I said, this went on for 3 days, three nights. And at the end of it, everybody was basically told, you know, you won't talk about this, but we know what the reason for these encounters were. You actually didn't see flying saucers. You just saw, you mistakenly saw high-flying seed pods, which is probably the strangest explanation, the most outrageous explanation that the official world's ever come up with to explain away a UFO incident involving qualified pilots. In other words, they were saying instead of seeing large UFOs at a distance, if you like, the pilots were mistakenly seeing seed pods at a very close distance and thinking they were large objects far away, which, of course, makes a mockery, you know, of the idea that the trained pilots, all of them, would mistakenly, you know, see something like this. But and this sort of stayed with Cooper for years, and he never forgot about it. And he actually had he was involved in another profound UFO incident in 1957 when he was working at the experimental flight test engineering division at Edwards Air Force Base in California. It was one particular morning in May 57 when two of his colleagues were out at a dry lake bed at Edwards filming and taking photographs of aircraft coming into land. It was basically for another project on the base. And as they were there and filming, again, like a classic flying saucer type craft, actually hovered over the lake bed, briefly landed for a time, and then shot away into the distance. But fortunately, having the presence of mind and the fact that they got cameras and filming equipment with them, they actually captured evidence of this craft on film and brought it back to Cooper, who recognized the importance of it, contacted the Pentagon, and the Pentagon said, don't develop the film, whatever you do, that's an order. Just send it over to us, and we'll take it from there. But Cooper said that although he was told not to develop the footage, which he didn't, he said no one ever said to him, don't look at it. So he actually looked at the negatives and said, you know, he could see the object, whatever it was. The interesting thing was that when it reached the Pentagon, it vanished. It was never seen again outside of official channels. So it was things like this that really convinced Cooper that there was a genuine phenomenon. And then when he retired from NASA, he was, as I said, on the Mercury Man program going into space, in 1978 and 1985, the United Nations was lobbied to try and set up a UFO investigation program. Now, unfortunately, this didn't come to pass, but Cooper was so sufficiently impressed by the fact that the UN might well set a professional body, he actually lent his support to it and prepared a statement in which you made a number of provocative and significant words, which I'll quote you a few. He said, "I think it's accepted that these things do exist. I think we now want to know the nature, the origin, and the intent of these sources. From my association with aircraft and spacecraft, I think I have a pretty good idea of what everyone on this planet has and their performance capabilities. And I'm sure some of the UFOs, at least, are not from anywhere on Earth. I believe these extraterrestrial vehicles and their crews are visiting this planet from other planets which are a little more technically advanced than we are on Earth." Now, you know, if somebody like me says that, people might just say, well, that's interesting, you know, he's written a book. But when you realize those words coming out of the mouth of a NASA astronaut who walked, who traveled into space, you know, to me that takes things to a whole nother level and demonstrates why this is sort of so critically important, if you like.
You go into the book about Area 51, various stories, Apollo flights of fancy. You've got all kinds of different points of interest, including information about a whistleblower. But I wanted to move forward into 1970s Europe, and you have a report about a September night in the El Ferro de Cadillo region of Spain about a UFO and the witnesses that saw this event go on, and that was in September. Then there was one in March that had police officers, a car salesman, they more than one person seeing this huge aluminum-colored craft. And you said it was like the shape of huge pencils, 500 to 600 feet in length, flying very slowly and at near perilously low levels. And then smaller aircraft, like little mushrooms. I think of today how we have drones. And that's first thing that came into my mind was drones when I started reading this. I said, my goodness, we're just copycat what these, you know, whatever this intelligence is doing. We have managed to copycat because that's what drones do. You send out the drones to make sure, because if something happens to a drone, okay, it's a machine. It's gone. But it's not a life, if you will. And this is something that I think many times people have seen, not knowing what they were looking at. What's your take on this?
Well, yeah, I think that's a good point. You know, that today we're developing drone-like craft, some that are used on sort of reconnaissance spy missions, some that, you know, can even be used for, like, domestically, you know, crowd monitoring, that sort of thing. And a lot of them, as time passes, you know, they do look like classic flying saucers. You know, the more our technology develops, it's becoming more and more difficult to differentiate between what might be ours and somebody else's. But you're quite right. That particular report you're talking about was one that was forwarded to NASA that deeply interested NASA for some reason. They were closely following reports of UFOs in the sort of early to mid-70s all across the world, you know, demonstrating that they had some sort of deep interest. And you're quite right, a lot of these reports do sound, you know, somewhat like the sort of things we're developing today. So, you know, I do believe in some respects some UFOs could be evidence of classified military technology. But I think when we go back to sort of the 70s and earlier, you know, we're clearly seeing things that, if we were flying those sorts of things then, you know, why weren't we using them, say, for example, in the Vietnam War or the Korean War? You know, I think what we've done is to sort of learn and understand and apply UFO themes, if you like, to our technology as it advances. But I think that clearly that might be the answer for some reports today, but clearly not for, you know, when we're going back decades and decades, I think.
You have really some fascinating stories in here, but I wanted to chat about one of your cases that took place in 1974 in Framley, England, and it was under the auspices of GEC Marconi, and that was the Marconi Underwater Systems Limited and Marconi Space and Defense Systems. And they were very significant in the military-based research and development programs for the British Ministry of Defense. They had a break-in. And that break-in was quite serious. And
yeah, this
when
is,
go ahead.
Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt. This is sort of a very weird story. It actually came to me directly from a woman who worked at this place. Marconi is a company that does a great deal of work with the British government. It's not an arm of the government. It's sort of like a company that's contracted on, you know, military programs and things like that. And one of the departments that Marconi runs is called the Marconi Space and Defense Systems. And, you know, my speculation is that because of Marconi's role in space research, that might be one of the reasons why the report reached NASA. But the date of this event was early 74, and the woman I interviewed was a draftswoman who worked in the Central Services branch at this particular location at Frimley. And she related this story about how, on arriving at work one day, it was clear that something significant and worrying had gone on. There were sort of military police personnel and British Ministry of Defense, which is the equivalent of the Department of Defense here, sort of running around the building and swarming around the base. And she asked one of her superiors, you know, what's happened? Is something serious going on? And they said, well, yes. And it transpired that the previous night, when one of the security guards patrolling the base was wandering around on his sort of regular nightly routine and, you know, regular tour of the buildings and the corridors and rooms and that sort of thing, he was going down one particular corridor when he could see, like emanating from underneath the door of the room, like a bright light, kind of like, you know, imagine the light had been left on in the room. But this was sort of a weird-looking, dazzling, almost like a metallic blue light that was sort of penetrated under the door. And so he realized this, you know, wasn't an everyday thing. So he flung open the door and said he saw this very strange-looking non-human creature, if you like, in the room, which was actually sifting through pages of classified files in a filing cabinet. And he said that, you know, whatever this entity was, it was human-shaped, but distinctly not human, and had the light was actually emanating from some sort of the front of this, like some sort of helmet that the creature was wearing. And when it saw the guard burst through the room, after a second or two, it literally just sort of vanished in the blink of an eye, and the man went into a state of shock, unsurprisingly, and the whole thing was hushed up and, you know, just simply not talked about at all. And, of course, you know, it had an air of the whole UFO issue about it as well, but also it almost had like an air of like a ghostly encounter too. You know, this entity sort of vanishing in the blink of an eye, and it was sort of a very strange one. And the mere fact that it reached NASA, you know, is an indication to me at least that they've taken interest in some sort of very unusual and esoteric areas, if you like.
I think it's absolutely fascinating when you think that Gene Roddenberry with Star Trek had transporters, and they even had one particular program. Yes, for those of you listening, I am a Star Trek fan. And I really remember this one very vividly, where they entered the one portrayal that Roddenberry had, he and his group had written out, was that they had entered into a time, an Earth time, and they had to be very careful that they didn't interfere with anything, and they had to make sure that people's memories were erased of their even being there. And I know I'm just giving a brief overview, but look at something like this. You have, using Roddenberry's description, a transporter, where someone using headgear, like a coal miner's lamp, effectively, it's probably even better than that, they're able to review, read those documents, track those documents, take them in, and then just sort of disappear. I know, folks, you're listening to this, you say, Donna, you really are out of space. But seriously, the technology is there. We just haven't reached it yet. People have been trying to accomplish this for a long time. And when you think of how countries around the world have their spy networks, they're in existence today, where they do this type of thing, trying to find out what the other person is doing so they can stay on top of it. How far-fetched is this? I don't think this is that far-fetched. Do you?
No, I don't. And I think, you know, you make an important point that, I mean, we only have to look at our technology today. You know, it was barely 100 years ago that the Wright brothers first took to the skies in sort of rudimentary aircraft. Now we're sending space probes out of the solar system. That's in 100 years, you know. So if somebody got a head start on us of 2,000 years, their technology would probably be so mind-bogglingly advanced, it would just seem like magic to us, you know, or it would just be unbelievable. I think it's
Absolutely.
Often our ego as human beings to imagine that what we know right now is all there is to know and we're the best at it, you know, which is probably far from the case.
I think so. This is Donna Sebo. My goodness, Nick, you have just got an intriguing book here. It makes for wonderful reading, and what conversations you could have with people. And this is what curiosity is all about. The NASA conspiracies? Well, you'd be the one that would have to make the determination of whether or not you feel it's true or if it is totally made up. A lot of it isn't. It's documented. Nick Redfern has been my guest. Now, if you want more information about Nick and his work, go to nickredfern.com, N-I-C-K-R-E-D-F-E-R-N. Nick, we're out of time. My goodness, that just evaporated away so quickly. Thank you for being my guest today.
Well, thanks again, Donna. I appreciate it. Thank you for having me on the show.
Thank you, sir. This is Donna Sebo. We're taking a break, and Susan Harmon is coming up next, so don't go away. We'll be right back.
Are you concerned about nutrition? Do you work hard to eat right, try to feed yourself and your family nutritious food? Well, you'll want to know about glyconutrients. What are they? These are sugars that are present in nature, however, we're not getting them in our food anymore. Scientific study is proving that these sugars are necessary for all cellular and immune system function. Over 20,000 studies are conducted each year on glycoforms alone. These are the sugar protein structure that line each and every cell of the body. 4 out of the last 8 Nobel Prizes in physiology have been awarded for research in the area of cellular communication and how these sugars work in the body. This is Donna Sebo. Every day I bring to you information that will empower and light up your life. I would like to invite you to visit my website, DelphiInternational.com, and find out more about these glyconutrients. That's DelphiInternational.com. Go to my website, go to the left side of the screen, tap on the button that says glyconutrients. MIT's Technology Review, February 2003, states that glycomics is one of the 10 emerging technologies that will change the world. Education is the key to advancement of understanding and making our lives better. Visit my site, DelphiInternational.com. Go to the left side of the screen and tap on the button that says glyconutrients. I know it'll make a difference for you, as it has for me.
As a counselor, Donna Sebo is available for private consultations by appointment. These can be done by telephone or in person. If you'd like to schedule an appointment with Donna, call 253-582-5604 or 800-872-8852. That's 253-582-5604 or outside of Pierce County, 800-872-8852.
Hi, this is Donna Sebo. We have as our second guest today, Susan Harmon, and as I've been telling you for the past few weeks, we have got a wonderful event here in the Pacific Northwest. That is the Emerald Spiral Expo, and this is actually one of the oldest expos that is in the state of Washington. It just recently changed its name, but it has been around a long time. Welcome to the show, Susan.
Hi, Donna. Thanks for having me.
Now, Susan, Emerald Spiral, give us a little bit of information about that. You are located here in the Pacific Northwest. How long have you been in the Seattle area, and what is Emerald Spiral all about?
Well, Emerald Spiral is located at 5910 California Avenue Southwest in Seattle. We've been open about 2.5 years. We are an artistic and spiritual cooperative. We have many members doing a whole variety of things, and we're trying to make a difference here in the world.
Well, I know that this event is wonderful, and the reason it is that there are so many wonderfully talented people, and this is being held at Kent Commons in Kent, Washington.
Yes, we have a link.
Yes. Yeah, you have a link on your website.
Absolutely, with directions.
Right, and that's emeraldspiral.com. The different people that you have there, one of the things I like about this event is that it's very family-oriented. You can come in, and it's so comfortable, and it's just absolutely marvelous in presence. And a lot of the people, including myself, have been associated with this for a number of years.
Well, yes. I mean, a lot of us have been involved for a very long period of time. We took over last spring. This will be our third time of doing this, simply because this is such a long-standing. In fact, they think it's the oldest continuous-running psychic fair in the United States.
Oh, in the United States? That's
interesting. Yeah, we know it's the oldest in the state of Washington, but possibly even in the country. I don't want to make that claim without knowing for sure. But it is an event that helps so many people, and it's a free admission. It's free parking. There's speakers every hour that cost nothing. There's door prizes every hour. It's a marvelous event. We have a snack bar. You know, you can buy, you can, you know, get coffee and pastries and soda pop and popcorn and, you know, all of these things. It's a wonderful event. We have everything from Tibetan clothing to readers. You know, John Skierman is going to do our welcoming this time. We've pulled him out of the booth. He's not too thrilled about that because he's so popular that people have to sign up. Wait, he always has this long waiting list. But we have a number. I sell stones, but a number of other people selling stones and jewelry and clothing and books. We have authors. We have Donna Lynn as one of our speakers, who is doing a workshop here on Monday and Tuesday after the expo on numerology. Her book, Breaking the Code, is probably the best researched book on numerology as well as being channeled.
One of the things that I think is so special about the Emerald Spiral is that the attitude of the people who are participating there, and I think you have, what, about 150 vendors?
Pretty close, yeah.
Yeah, so you've got quite a group of people. But what I like is the openness of conversation. So many times when people come to an event of this kind, they are not able to really have a conversation with people. They're either very busy or there's just not what I call the ambiance of openness. And that's one of the gifts that I think is given to anybody that comes into this event, which, again, for those of you that are just tuning in, this is the Emerald Spiral. I have Susan Harmon on the line with me, and we're talking about this event that's going to be held at the Kent Commons in Kent, Washington. And for any of you that are listening from anywhere else in the country, and I know you're not going to be able to make it in for the event, but you can go in and find out about the Emerald Spiral, a lot of their activities and the various things that they have available by going to their website, emeraldspiral.com. Now, you mentioned Donna Lynn, who's going to be one of your speakers. Who else do you have coming up as a speaker?
Well, Donna Lynn is coming in from Dallas, which is why this is so exciting. We are also going to have Walter Pullen with his new book that has just come out, and it's Evolution of the Spirit. It's a fantastic, fantastic book. He just got back from Peru, and, you know, he'll be speaking. We've got Mark Dodich, who's going to be talking about, you know, how all this astrological stuff that's going on, you know, is going to impact on everybody. I mean, you know, Uranus shifting and the Earth changes. John will talk a little bit about that, too. Judy May is an author of three self-help books. She'll be speaking. Todd Rolson, he makes these incredible shields. He'll, you know, he's another speaker. And Gary Mance, who's on KKNW, is also going to be speaking.
Well, you've got quite a lineup there.
Well, yeah, and we're going to end up with the people from Vashon Intuitive Arts, that is a co-op that, you know, we supported energetically and everything for them to get going, about the advantages of people joining together and forming cooperatives.
Well, I think that is a very good idea. And in today's world, because of technology, what's wonderful is that there can even be an interconnection via
Absolutely.
Technology that I think is quite special, especially when you are able to have the visual interactions with Skype and other things like this. We live in an incredible period, and I think that people are very open to exploring the intuitive venues and also the scientific aspect of this. And again, I'll bring the point around once more, is that this is a good time. If you're in the state of Washington, you have a chance to come to the event, which is this Saturday. If you have a chance to come to the event, you can walk up to just about anybody, unless they're busy doing something. You can walk up to them and ask them questions. And it's not often you have that opportunity. And this is such a wonderful format. Again, I've been involved with it for a number of years, and I just thoroughly enjoy being a participant. And I've just met so many wonderful, wonderful, sincere individuals that really give a heart and soul into everything that they do. And I love the creative things. There's a couple that's they do all of their own design work, and they just do an incredible job with different materials and, like you said, the people with the stones. Now, Susan, you yourself have been involved in the area of the intuitive skill set for a great deal of your life.
My entire life, yeah.
When you decided that you were going to become a person that's going to oversee this event every year, what has been some of the exciting advantages that you have discovered in doing this?
Well, exhaustion, it's always good for the soul.
That's a good answer. I know, yes, that is so true.
I mean,
cause it's
you know, I'm still typing out the stuff to get to the printers for the program that should have gone 2 days ago because we've had last-minute changes, you know. But it is wonderful, and some of our new people that are coming in, one of the hypnotherapists and one of the, you know, they're just some so much exciting things. We have people that, you know, have done it year after year, and we have new people doing things every year. And every year that we've done it, we've had a waiting list. You know, we've got a waiting list now of people that want to be vendors because it's a good day for them, too. I mean, it's a wonderful event. The people that come get their needs met. That's what's the most important thing, and that's what everybody looks at. What is it that we need to do to provide, you know, an arena so that people can get their needs met? And that, I think, is what our goal, both in Emerald Spiral, in our co-op, and our goal for the expo. It's just it's a great day. It is a lot of work. You know, there's a tremendous amount that goes into this. I mean, without all the volunteers we have, we couldn't possibly carry it off. But it is a very satisfying to be involved in this.
Well, now, this is at Kent Commons in Kent, Washington.
Right.
And on your website, emeraldspiral.com, people can go in there. They can find out about the event. They can get the directions. There's no admission to this, but as you
said,
there's
free parking.
Yeah, and there's free parking. And it is really just a terrific event. I got one of my authors that I did an interview with, and just fact last week, with someone that I found out about last fall, Dr. Lundell, who was a person that was being represented by someone at the event, and he was just a marvelous person to have on the air. So you never know what you're going to come away with when you participate in something like this, whether you are a vendor, as I'm going to be, or you are someone who is just wanting to see what it's all about and you have a curiosity. This is a very safe environment. It's a friendly environment. It's an exciting environment. Oh, yes, and children are welcome.
children are welcome.
It's, yes,
you know,
it's totally oriented towards families. Anybody can come in.
Right.
Bring your, you know, whoever you want. And just come comfortable because you will just find that there's a lot more to see than what you would have ever expected, but it's in a convenient location. The price is right. The environment is warm and friendly, and it's something that a lot of people like to put on their calendars to do again and again. Now, I know we're just about out of time, Susan. The website is emeraldspiral.com, and is there anything else you'd like to add before we close out?
Well, you know, Donna, you're so efficient on how you... You know, you get it all said in a very short, concise way, and still with a tremendous amount of warmth. I think you covered everything pretty well. I do encourage people to come out for this event because people are always surprised at something that happens that they weren't expecting to, and it's always a pleasant surprise.
Yes, it is. And that's what I love about anything that has to do with the intuitive processes. It brings you into an experience that is going to add something to your day in a very special way. Susan Harmon, thank you so much. EmeraldSpiral.com. Check out their website. I will be there myself. And do come by and say hello. This is Donna Sebo. We are taking a break. We will be back in just a moment. Don't go away.
If you're searching for the perfect gift for a child, consider God's Kiss by Donna Sebo. That's right. Donna is not only a mental practitioner and psychic, she's an author as well. God's Kiss beckons all children and the young at heart to enter the dream world of a little traveler named Johnny. You can order your book today by sending a check or money order to Mrs. Sebo's Classics, Post Office Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497. That's Post Office Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497. If you'd like both the book and cassette, you pay $19.95 plus applicable tax and shipping charges. This is the book for your favorite child of any age. Donna Sebo's God's Kiss is about a child's sense of place in the world, and it's destined to be a children's classic. Order now. Call 800-872-8852. God's Kiss is written by Donna Sebo and illustrated by Ed Ged Rose. Buy it today. 800-872-8852.
Donna Sebo publishes a popular, inspirational, and insightful newsletter filled with information about her upcoming guests, her travel schedule, seminar presentations, and upbeat articles to lighten up your life. You can subscribe to this free monthly newsletter by emailing her at donna@delphiinternational.com. That's donna@delphiinternational.com. You can also go to her website, www.delphiinternational.com, and review past publications. Keep in touch with Donna through this monthly publication. Again, her email address is donna@delphiinternational.com, and her website is www.delphiinternational.com.
Hi, this is Donna. By the way, someone contacted me this morning asking if I do private readings for people. Yes, I do. And this is something, if this is something you're interested in, you can always call me at my office, 800-872-8852 or 253-582-5604. Now, quickly, I want to share this cute story with you because it just, we're coming into spring. A lot of people here in the Pacific Northwest are going to be camping. And it's all about a friend, and her, Mary Alice is the one that sent this. And she said, it was my friend's first camping trip with her husband, and they were lost. He tried all the usual tactics to determine direction. Moss on the trees? There was no moss. Moss, let's see, direction of the sun? You couldn't see it. It was overcast. Typical Northwest weather, right? Right. And so, and so, and so. You got it. There was nothing that came described in his Boy Scout manual that said which way they were to go. Well, she started to panic. However, the friend's husband spotted a cabin in the distance, and he said, this way. And he started leading her back to camp. And she asked her husband said, she said, how did you do that? He said, oh, that's simple. In this part of the country, the satellite dishes point north. Thank goodness for satellite dishes. Don't you just love it? This is Donna Sebo, and telephone number, if you wanted to give me a buzz, is 888-815-9756. Okay, here are two more signs with your spring horoscope for spring 2011. We're going to be talking about Scorpios and Sagittarians. Yes, all right. For those of you born under the sign of Scorpio, April is going to make you happy. Money seems to be clinking in your cash register. That's right. You are going to find yourself really feeling good about how your money flow is going and how you're working with your money flow. So you are on target. That's great. Now, what about your family and, you know, maybe a special person in your life? Well, harmony is in your space. During the spring, take advantage of it. If you're looking for that Mr. or Ms. Special, then realize you have to be open and receptive to that. And make yourself ready for it. That sounds a little strange, doesn't it? But really, you need to think about that. And then it looks like you're going to stay a little bit close to home. I think you're going to want to save your dollars because there's going to be perhaps a special excursion that you may want to take. It's going to require some capital, and it'd be wise for you just to save up as much as you can. Find those places that you can go to locally that gives you that break, that doesn't cost a lot of money and still have just as much fun. And keep that savings account for that special event that you may want to participate in, because when you do make that special trip, it's going to be one where you want to make sure you have the cash to go along with it. Okay, for those of you under the sign of Sagittarius, well, you know what? There's a lot of people that are looking out for you, and when it comes to family, which is pretty significant for you, even though there may have been some disruptions in family environments. Don't worry about that. We all have it, and you'll get through it. But you're going to find certain family members very supportive of you, your ideas, your concepts. And if you want to be that entrepreneur, find those family members that you can mentor with, who can help keep you on track of your objectives. You also are going to find that linking up with individuals, whether they are family or they're other professionals that you have a deep regard for, that's going to be your ace. This is the year where you want to lay out your plans carefully, and don't try to move too fast on them. Take your time. Remember, usually projects take you about 3 times longer than you expect to accomplish them, so don't be impatient. Be patient. As far as traveling goes, well, it looks like little mini vacations will work out better for you this spring. And if you are willing to be patient with those little mini breaks, maybe it's going out with friends one night during a week, or maybe it's taking a weekend and you just have a getaway overnight, something that's going to be fun for you. Remember, treat yourself. Don't try to make this an excursion to Antarctica. You want to have fun. You want to have these little mini vacations that are going to leave you refreshed, energized, and ready to go. So we still have Cancer, Leo, Virgo, Capricorn, Aquarius, and Pisces to cover. Yes. So that will be coming up next. Donna Sebo here. Give me a buzz if you'd like to chat. 888-815-9756. Now, I was sent some information by a author that I had had on, and this was by Jeff Raisley, and he had gotten a letter from people in Nepal that he had helped. And Jeff was on my show last month, and I just thought I would share it with you, because so frequently we are unaware of what other people in the world have to live with and what they experience. And this is what Jeff got. And he sent me this letter, Jeff Raisley, as the author. And it was Namaste from Bassa Village. He said, Donna, I thought you might enjoy this email I received about completion of the hydroelectric project in Bassa Village. Now, Jeff goes to Nepal and has come to know this village quite well. And these people have not had electricity. They haven't had anything like this. And this is what they sent him in the way of an email. God bless technology. They said, Dear Jeff Dai, Namaste from Ganesh Bahai. So, how are you and your family? I hope you are in good health and everything's doing well there. We are also very fine here and everything's going well. This time I'm going to send this mail from Namachi Bazaar. And just yesterday I come for the trekking for the 12 days from the village. 12 days it took him to get to this place. Then this time I was a long time in the village, so I wasn't able to send mail. So for the electric project, we finished completely, and we really got very nice light this time. All the village people are very happy with this, and they feel like a dream this time, and they cannot express the happiness that they have, but they express from their faces how much they are happy nowadays for the light. While I would like to give you thank you very much for your great support for all, and thank you very much for all our donors. And without your support, we cannot do nothing. So thank you very much for your big support for the backward people and village. So I hope that when you will be in Bassa, you will be satisfied for this project, and we will start more project in Bassa. And it's going to be one example for a remote area. Of course, it's not easy for all, I hope everyone is not disappointed for our work and everybody will be satisfied with what they paid us. I hope to send you pictures from the electric photos. And I did have a photo said, please stay in good health, have a nice time, see you via next email. Now stop and think about it. Here in this country, we have been able to develop an infrastructure that just about anywhere we go, unless we're out in the boonies somewhere, we have light. We have lanterns that have LED lights now that, you know, give a tremendous amount of light. We have developed batteries, but most of us walk into our environments, flick a switch, and it's there. These people are just now getting electricity. It's amazing. Well, we're out of time. This is Donna Sebo. Remember, always, you're the master of your fate. You are the captain of your soul. Tomorrow, we'll talk about stop peeing on your shoes. That's right. We're going to tell you how you can work and find your dream job. Julie Bark is going to be my guest tomorrow. You're the greatest. Thank you so much for being with me today. Gotta go. Bye for now.
You have been listening to The Donna Sebo Show. If you would like a copy of today's broadcast, send $10 to The Donna Sebo Show, P.O. Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497-0272. Be sure to put the date of the broadcast in your request. If you are not able to be a part of today's program, join Donna and her guests Monday through Friday, and she will be here to take your calls. Thank you for listening and being part of our program. Have a wonderful day.